Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for the Sunday before the start of the Georgia legislative session. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening.
Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, everyone.
Yes, well, I'm glad y'all could both make it. I'm broadcasting live from the Wild Hog Supper, so if you hear a little bit in the background, it's just the estimated crowd of 3,000 people. So many folks in Georgia government, really on both sides of the aisle. I believe this is probably the largest bipartisan political event of the year. Catherine, I know you've been down here in past years. What would you say about that?
Oh, I think that's right. Now, last year I was down there and Michelle Obama was there, so it was really a madhouse. But it's always fun, and, you know, it's a lively crowd. And did you get to eat some hog?
Oh, that's the first thing. We got here pretty early. Bob Herndon of the Atlanta Barbecue Club provided some tickets, and we got here early, and then we partake of the food, and then we started trying to network a little bit. And I tell you what, one thing I've noticed is, you know, last year Michelle Obama was a big star. This year it seems to be, I hate to say this, but gubernatorial candidates on the Republican side. You see the news media really interviewing a lot of those candidates. I guess Karen Handel's been down here. Casey Cagle's probably standing 5 feet away from me. John Oxendine's been around. And then also, Lynn Westmoreland, which is a name I'd heard rumored before about running for governor, he was down here and getting interviewed by the media. And I remarked to some of my friends down here, I said, you know, why would you come down from a federal office to a state thing if all you knew, all you were going to get was people asking you for federal favors and federal money to help bail out, you know, either state or local budget issues? Initial thoughts on that, Tim?
Well, the first thing I've got to ask Lynn Westmoreland is when he already knows that Casey Cagle and John Oxendine and Karen Handel are all in the race, do you think this is a race he would want to take on against three party heavyweights like that?
I don't know, but there's only been two federal officials I've seen here. That would be himself and then Phil Gingrey, and I would say that, you know, from what I saw, Lynn Westmoreland was working the room much harder, working the media a little more. But then also there has been Democratic candidates. David Poitras, the general, has been down here meeting a lot of folks. He's the announced candidate. And then on the unannounced side, you've had you've had DeBose Porter, Representative Porter, and Commissioner Michael Thurman both here. So it's definitely a place where politicians are being seen and seeing others. But I guess this is the annual pre-event before the kickoff of the legislature, and I guess everybody's having a good time, but they can't be looking too much forward to basically a session that's going to be cutting the budget. Catherine, what's your thought on the cutting the budget, what we look for in the session?
Oh, boy, it's going to be a tough session on the budget. I mean, it's just, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't have any thoughts on it. I haven't been, you know, I mean, we'll have to wait and see how things go this week, I guess.
Well, David, you know, if I could jump in here, tax revenues, as you saw this morning, are down about 9%. It's rumored that they're going to have to cut about $2.2 billion in spending. Have you heard anything around the room about anything like that tonight, about where these cuts might be coming from? Or,
well, I have not heard anything like that. Obviously, I did see the GAE official. I saw the head of the GAE. I did see and met the superintendent of schools for Clayton County. So obviously, education being the largest budget item, you assume that that's going to be one area they cut, which, and then you think about it, they've already rumored, and this I get from school systems, not from down here at this event, they're talking about adding two children to class size limits for the rest of the school year, And I guess that could even carry on into next year. And that ends up being, over the course of a school and system, teachers that then begins to add up to real revenue. And that's one rumor I have heard.
Well, that rumor apparently is true, because the Georgia gang was talking about that very thing this morning, and it's going to be done at all age levels, so it's going to affect you folks in education heavily.
Yes, and that's something, I mean, if you're looking at two parts of it, if they were to do some of it now, it means switching classes around, which I don't think, in where at least where I teach, there's going to be too much of that, or places around where in our area. But then next year, you know, a lot of schools are looking. They may have to cut a teacher or two. And if people retire, that won't be so painful. But if people don't retire in a school, that can mean transfers and, in certain situations, reduction in force. And that's just something you just don't hear about in a growing area like the Sun Belt. I know, Catherine, being up from Michigan, that happened a little more frequently in past years.
Yeah, but, yeah, well, Michigan's a whole nother story right now, so we can avoid that today.
Yes, well, being in education circles, reading Education Week, you do hear some about that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, I guess just looking at this governor's race, I talked about the people being here. I know y'all been looking up on that. Catherine, what's your first thought on the governor's race?
Well, you know, I looked at their most recent filings on their funding for the Republicans, and the three leading candidates, I guess, Handel, Oxendine, and Cagle, all have about the same amount of money. Karen Handel's got like $1.2 million left over from her Secretary of State race. Oxendine's just got just over $1 million, and Cagle's got about the same, about $1.2 million. So, and then Poitras, I didn't get to Poitras. But he's got, like, what did he report, like, 250?
Yeah, I think before I left, they said that Casey Cagle has been raising more money recently than John Oxendine. So that was the what I read before I left. Tim, you're using the fact checker. Is that accurate?
Oh, okay, David, we have another caller on the line.
Well, I believe
go ahead,
that, that is Scott Aikman getting ready to book us a guest. Let's give Scott another moment. Just keep that open, Tim, and we're going to get this guest on in just a moment. But then, speaking of fundraising, I know on the Democratic side, I saw David Poitras had raised, you know, about $300,000. But what I was kind of taken by was that he still has cash on hand around $282,000, which means he's only spent about $18,000. And in politics, the term burn rate, that is a very, very low burn rate, which – if you're running a campaign on the Democratic aisle in Georgia, you want to have a low burn rate.
Yeah.
But at the same time, wouldn't he want to be spending some of this money to get his name out there to maybe establish himself as a front runner before anybody else gets in the race?
Yes. Well, you know that he's already printed cards that are full color that look nice. He and his wife are working the room, and he hired a campaign manager, a friend of the program, obviously, Wendy Davis, who's joined us a handful of times, just one of those just a few weeks ago. So, you know, I guess he's starting to spend a little bit of money and putting people in place. But, you know, sometimes you see campaigns that they start the campaign, they raise a little money, and they spend it on just absolute nonsense. And I just was, you know, thought that that was a good sign that his burn rate was so low.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Let me throw this in. There's one name we have not mentioned, and it's a name that's in the back of everybody's mind, Republican and Democrat together. Anybody been hearing anything about Roy Barnes?
Catherine, I'm sure you've heard stuff too, but I will say he's not in the room. Catherine, what have you heard?
I haven't heard much about him lately. I'm surprised he's not there.
Catherine and Tim, we've got our first guest on the line. Representative DeBose Porter, minority leader in the State House, is with us. Welcome, Representative Porter.
Good to be with you.
Yes. Well, tell us, what are you looking for in this budget, this general session? We know budget's going to be a big issue.
Well, what it boils down to, what are our priorities? We've got to get our kids educated. We've got to get their parents jobs. And that ought to be the priority for Georgia.
Yes, and transportation, we know that's going to be a big issue. What are you seeing there?
Well, one of the main things we need to do is build a relationship with the new administration in Washington. If we can leverage the money in this state to leverage a lot more money, I will put more money in the ground here. And we have such a long list of things that have just been backing up in transportation. We've got to do something in mass transit. We've got to relieve the congestion in Atlanta. You've got to have some money for intersections and state aid for things out in the state. So, you know, the priorities in transportation is key is whether Georgia's going to be able to move forward or not.
Yes, well, I know you meet a lot of folks here, but one question, last question for you. What's one thing that's going to happen this session that maybe the media is not covering and we don't see?
The lack of a relationship with Washington, with Georgia's administration. That has got to get built. It's got to get built quickly. When you hear people referring to Georgia as the orphan state, we've got to overcome that and overcome that quickly.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, anything else for the people on the kudzu vine?
Well, so let's just see what's going to happen this session. We, like I said, those priorities have got to be met, and we've got to get away from across the board cuts, and look at the real priorities of the state and how we need to fund that and keep it, or Georgia's going to fall back.
Yes, I think you're right. I noticed that Georgia has not grown as much in the last year of the census numbers as it has in previous years.
Well, when you have headhunters because of our transportation problem in Atlanta that are recommending Charlotte and Nashville because of the lack of leadership of getting a plan on the ground in transportation. That has got to be done. We're behind. It should have passed last year. It didn't. And now you have the three sides flopping now. The Democratic caucus is ready for a plan. We're willing to go with a transportation splash for communities and counties. We're also insisting that that fourth penny of sales tax be allocated for transportation so that we can commit the federal money to draw down 90% of the money for mass transit and have it available for other economic development projects.
Yes. Well, Representative Porter, thanks for coming on the Kudzu Vine, and we hope to have you again on the show.
Anytime. Good to be with you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, there was one of our candidates that, you know, has been rumored to run for governor. We said this was going on. He's telling me, yes, he's been rumored, and that's good news. Tim, I think we actually have your state representative with us. If our producer doesn't hang up the phone, we may get her on. Representative Reese, if you'd like to be on the phone with Tim Shiflett and Catherine Smith on the Kudzu Vine, we got Tim on the line. Tim, go ahead and ask Representative Reese some questions.
Barbara, how are you doing this evening?
We're doing fine.
I want to ask you a question immediately because education is your background. Have you heard anything about the possibility of classroom sizes being increased across the board?
There was a bill passed that would allow that after approval from the state board where school systems applied for flexibility. And then later when the governor did the 6% cut and cut education 2%, shortly around that time, he came out with an executive order that allows flexibility, and I believe classroom size is one of those that they can use. I'm not sure what the difference is and the number of pupils per classroom that can actually be there.
Okay, and the other question that I wanted to ask you was, DeBose Porter was just on, and he mentioned across the board cut. Is that what we're looking at in all departments?
I hope it's not what we're looking for in all departments because I am not in favor of across-the-board cuts. Public safety, if we have an 8% across-the-board cut in public safety, we're getting to the bone. And we're going to endanger not only our employees, such as our state troopers and our corrections officers, but we're going to endanger the general public if public safety is cut much more. already we're shorthanded in the State Patrol, and, you know, our GBI medical examiner has been moved to Atlanta, and just multiple problems in public safety if we have to have a large cut again.
Okay, thank you. Barbara, David?
Yes, and Catherine, also, if you have questions, feel free to just jump on in.
I will jump on in.
Yeah, it's just interesting trying to do interviews in this way. And I think, Scott, are you keeping that line open? You're keeping that line open. That's good. We can wait a second. We've got to have our next guest, but we're telling them they can finish their conversation since, once again, this is a place to meet people and press the flesh in person. But I think we have General David Poythress on the line with us. So welcome, General Poythress.
Hello. Yeah, hello, Tim. Glad to be with you.
Yes, General Poythress, I know we're running for governor. We need to give you an extended interview, which give you, 30 minutes on the line. But I know that you currently run a department of the Georgia government that works on defense. What are you looking at with that department coming out of this session?
Well, actually, I was the commander of the Georgia National Guard for several years. I have left that. I am now out of government. For the time being, I'm running for governor of Georgia in 2010. So I'm a full-time civilian running for governor now.
Well, that means that you can raise money, which we know you've had a fundraising report come out. One thing we remarked is your burn rate of spending money was incredibly low, which is a good thing, and obviously that points to good fiscal responsibility.
Well, we're doing very well. We're getting money from all points on the political spectrum, and this, of course, is a marathon and not a sprint, but we're getting a lot of support all around the state. I tell you, a lot of folks are ready for change in Georgia, just like they have been nationally. I think 2010 is the year that the Democratic Party is going to take back the governorship of Georgia.
We hope so, because this is a Democratic show. We're not ashamed of that. Catherine, do you have any questions for David Poythress?
Well, I'm just wondering, we're really happy that you hired Wendy Davis for your campaign manager, and I'm just wondering what you've got lined up for the coming, weeks or months in terms of getting the word out and spreading the word about David Poythress around the state, and, what kind of events you have planned and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you, Kathy. As I said, this is a marathon and not a sprint. Wendy is on board for only a week, and she's already doing a fabulous job helping us get out the message about a new day in Georgia. The Republicans have wrecked the economy of this country. The economy of Georgia is in the same situation. My priorities coming up are jobs. We need to focus on jobs and the things that create jobs in Georgia, and that's our water situation, our transportation, and our education. Those are the three strategic investments that we need to make to bring back the economy of Georgia to the prosperity that we used to enjoy a few years ago.
Yes, well, General, we thank you for coming on the program. And like I said, we want to have you back for a full interview in the next few weeks, really.
Thanks. We'd love to do it.
We'd
love
to
do it. We'd love to talk about the future of Georgia.
Great.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Dad.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. Okay, well, until we start our Alabama talk, and we may be even having another guest here before we even get to the 7:30 hour, but we've had other topics in other southern states we discussed. One, Jeb Bush is not going to run for U.S. Senate. Now, I think what everybody would think was a surprise. Tim, Catherine, did y'all see that as a surprise?
Oh, yeah.
A pleasant surprise.
Absolutely. My question, David, is why he would have been the favorite to win. Why would he not do this?
One would think. I don't know. I mean, the Bush name in Florida, he gets to be a little more of his own name as opposed to around the country, it's more about his brother. So it seemed like the race where he could have reestablished his own name in a bigger spectrum.
Is there any chance that he is bypassing this race in order to, shall we say, concentrate on a larger race in 2012?
I don't see that as being the angle to go. I think he needs to be in the Senate to get to that. But sometimes you just don't know what angles and paths people are thinking, but the way he shut the door so firmly, you don't see him going back on that. And then I guess another thing is in Virginia, we talked about the governor's race with Terry McAuliffe getting in the race, and then they had other candidates. They talked about Craig Deeds, I believe, and the other one escapes me. Tell me if y'all know the third candidate.
Got it here somewhere.
There were three candidates, but then one thing that came out this week is that Craig Deeds has a perfect voting record in Virginia elections, and the other two candidates, Terry McAuliffe and the third candidate, it's still escaping my mind, I know,
Brian Moran,
don't have perfect records, which my question to you, Tim and Catherine, is how much of an issue is that?
Well, if I was living in Virginia, I think it would be an issue. You know, if you're talking about how important it is to represent a state and, you know, you want to represent a state, then you should be voting. You should be a part, you should be engaged in that, in the electoral politics of that state. And it sounds like both Mr. McAuliffe and Mr. Moran have not been that engaged.
Yeah. Tim, your first thought on that?
Well, David, because we're political people, this would be pretty important to us. But let me throw you out an example of where I don't think it's that important to the average voter. In 1952, when Dwight Eisenhower ran for president, he was 62 years old, and guess what? He voted in his very first presidential election that year for himself.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
I think it's the kind of thing that it's going to be a feather in the cap for Craig Deeds, and he can certainly use it to his advantage, but I don't know that it hurts, if it hurts the other two that badly. But I think it's something he can tout, and rightfully so. I mean, that's why you show up when the polls are open, because you never know, how it'll benefit you. But it's certainly that Virginia governor's race being the first one that comes up, and usually that in the New Jersey, Mississippi, and Louisiana, there's such bellwether elections and those odd years that they're going to be watched all around the South. But I know there was other things on y'all's mind. Catherine, what topics in the political world have struck you this week?
Well, in Atlanta, there's been a lot of talk about crime. We've had a sort of increase in brazen, violent crimes in the Atlanta metro area in the last year, but there was a really awful crime committed on Tuesday night, and so there's a lot of talk about crime and a lot of talk about the furlough
yes.
of some officers, and so I think that crime is going to be, and I think that this will probably seep out into the legislature as well, because it's a huge issue in Metro Atlanta.
Yes,
well,
and talking about local issues, we actually have Lee May on the phone with us, DeKalb County Commissioner. Welcome, Commissioner May.
Hey, now it's good to see you and good to talk to you today. We're down here at the Freight Depot at the Wild Hog Dinner, and we're having a good time here. It's very important that we're here as local elected officials, kind of meeting and greeting with our state legislators, because they do make decisions that are affecting us, what we do at the local level in DeKalb County every day. So it's a great time here.
Yes. One question we had for you of substance, I guess, was Commissioner Burl Ellis is also in the room. We know DeKalb's kind of gotten a little bit of a new commission. What do you see happening in DeKalb in the next few years?
Well, today's economy and what's going on now in society is really no different in DeKalb County, and there are many pressing issues that DeKalb County and many other local jurisdictions are facing. And so it's important that we come together as a board and the CEO as the executive branch to really identify many of these issues and really address them. And it really takes a real strong partnership both with the local delegation of our county, state senators and state representatives, along with us locally elected officials, to really problem solve and really identify these issues and come up with creative solutions to address them.
Yes, well, we're certainly looking for the local governments to keep continuing showing leadership where sometimes the state government currently is not doing that.
Yeah, well, you know, where the state government is falling short, we have to pick up some of the pieces. And opposite is also true. Where we can't handle some of the issues, we rely on the state government to do the same. So it's truly a partnership that it takes to really address our issues.
Yes. Well, Commissioner May, we thank you for coming on, and we know that you've got people to meet and ice cream to eat.
Absolutely. Thanks, man, and talk to you soon.
Thanks again. Well, of course, Tim, let us know when Sherry from Alabama calls in, because I know
sure
it's
will.
Any moment now.
Sure will.
But, yes, well, Commissioner May, I've known Commissioner May for a while, one of the youngest leaders in politics, not just Democratic politics, you know, but he's a young family man, probably in his early to mid-30s, business leader, and just ran and won, and, you know, he's going to have a lot of experience before he's even long in the tooth, if you will.
David, if I may, I'd like to get back to the issue that Catherine was just talking about, which was crime in the city of Atlanta. And I'd like to ask Catherine, to your knowledge, Catherine, does this increase in crime have anything to do with budget cuts and less cops on the streets, stuff like that?
Well, there's certainly a lot of conversations about that because the city of Atlanta has, I can't remember how many, a couple hundred empty spots on the force, and they recently announced that each officer is going to be required to take one day of, unscheduled time off each pay period or month or something. And also, we all know that crime increases when people are struggling in the economy. It's a known fact. We've seen, you can look at the data on that for going back generations. And so, I think that the budget cuts and the struggling economy are hand in hand in some of these increases in crime. It's very shocking. It looks like we have someone calling in from area code 256.
Yes, this is our guest, I believe, from Alabama, David.
Yes, Sherry, welcome.
Thank you.
Sherry, I'm at the Wild Hog Supper, which I'm sure Alabama has an event that's very similar. It's a big bipartisan kickoff event, political in nature, before our legislative session opens. But so I may lean on Tim and Catherine a lot to ask these questions, because I don't have my technology in front of me, if you will. But for those of you that don't remember the time Sherry's been on before, she is the blogstress, I guess that's the term, of Left in Alabama, the premier political blog for Alabama politics, leftinalabama.com, and been reading it and noticing there's so many fascinating issues. So we're like, we got to have Sherry on to talk about what's going on in Alabama. Sherry, I guess first thing is, y'all have a little bit of a scandal over there in the Birmingham mayor's office. I know you don't live in Birmingham, I believe, but tell us what's going on there in your largest city.
Well, the mayor has been arraigned on corruption charges, federal corruption charges, that are in connection with the sewer bond mess is the only word for it. The Jefferson County is probably looking at bankruptcy. It's going to be the largest municipal bankruptcy in the nation ever. And it's because they got into this mess with the bond for the sewer system, and it's just like your adjustable rate mortgage. You know, it looks like a good thing when the rates were low, but then the rates went up, and they got in a big hole. And several members of the county commission have already been actually convicted. So it's nothing to do with Langford's time as mayor of Birmingham. This goes back to when he was on the county commission in Jefferson County.
So it's not his mayoral service. So that's good news, given that we've seen some mayoral scandals recently in other cities.
Yes. Years and years.
Yes. Well, it didn't sound like a good situation financially for Birmingham, but it is good for a public official not to be in as much trouble as it sounded like at first. Now, another thing that struck me is because you have two Democratic congressional wins, both in the Montgomery and Huntsville areas, that created two special elections. And, you know, special elections are always fun to cover because they're the only game in town. I guess let's look at your state capitol first. What's going on there with that Montgomery mayor's race?
Well, the mayor's race, there's the filing deadline isn't until the end of this month. So it's not completely clear who's going to run and who's not, but there's already several candidates. And last time there was a special election for mayor of Montgomery, something like 50 people filed to run. And they don't expect 50 this time, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see 10.
Yes, and we did know that one candidate, there was a little bit of controversy y'all wrote about, he is a Republican-leaning candidate because I believe the race is nonpartisan. Is that correct?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so he's a Republican-leaning candidate, but then he has hired a Democratic pollster, John Anzalone. Tell us about that controversy.
The candidate you're talking about is the county commission chairman, Todd Strange, and he has run as a Republican for county commission. So, you know, there's not a lot of doubt of where he is on the political spectrum. But he has hired basically the same team that put Bobby Bright in Congress, including Anzalone's firm. And that has ruffled a lot of Democratic feathers because, Anzalone is a political consultant that right now has his he's in tune with the electorate, is the way I like to look at it. You know, he knows the questions to ask and he knows what to do with the answers. But,
yes. Catherine, do you have any questions, Led, about Alabama politics?
No, but I find it very interesting to hear what you're talking about, though. So if you could just continue talking a little bit about, you know, how you're dealing with this, how people are responding to this use of a Democratic pollster. Like, are they putting pressure on him?
I've heard from several people who say they have called his office, talked to people in his office, or talked to his friends, and expressed extreme displeasure. And, you know, you look at this, and it's kind of like, look back at the conservative movement, and the people that did really well out of that, like Karl Rove and Richard Viguerie, the direct mail guru, you know, those guys saw an opportunity to make a good business out of doing something they believed in. It's not something we probably believe in, but they believed in the conservative movement, and they thought growing that movement would also be good for their business.
Right, and there's plenty of political strategists on the Democratic side who have done that too, and I think that we would challenge them if they were to up and support someone who is a known member of the GOP. So,
right. And
yes, we had a situation. Go ahead.
Whether he's a Democratic consultant or whether he's just a good consultant who will work for whoever. And it's not clear yet. I've heard that he's a good friend, is a good friend of the candidate, Todd Strange. And so it was a friendship kind of a thing, doing a favor for a friend, but it's just not clear.
Yes, we had a candidate in Georgia that was county commission chair of a large county that he hired an entire Republican team, and of course we can look at the candidate saying, you know, why didn't you support Democratic people? And then of course the Republicans, might have said, you know, why are you helping this Democrat? So
right, I mean, I
it
think
cuts a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that there's challenge. There would be. It's a challenge to that pollster or that consultant from both sides, I would think.
Sure. And to make it even more interesting, Anzalone worked for Bobby Bright. I mean, Todd Strange has hired pretty much Bobby Bright's whole team, but Bright has endorsed another candidate for mayor. He's endorsed Michael Bridell, who was his executive mayor's office. So it's a real strange loyalty allegiance thing going on down there in Montgomery.
Yes. Tim, next question on Alabama politics.
I'd like to jump in and mention the state Senate District 7 race to replace Parker Griffith. Could you tell us what's going on in that race, how many candidates on each side are running and stuff like that.
Okay, there's six Republicans and three Democrats, and I would expect it's going to be a Democratic seat, just because the last time they redrew the lines, the guy in that seat was a Democrat. The legislature was controlled by Democrats, and he has indicated he tried to bring in a few more Democratic voters, if you know what I mean.
And so our listeners will know exactly where you're talking about. Tell us where the Senate 7 seat is located in Alabama.
It's entirely within Madison County and includes most of Huntsville, right in the northern Alabama, right in the center near the Tennessee line. But it's Huntsville is, I think, the third largest city, so it's partly rural, but mostly an urban and suburban district. And the the Democratic candidates are, one is the state representative, Laura Hall, and her House district lies, I believe, entirely within the Senate district. She's an educator. She was an educator before she was elected, but she has a job with Calhoun Community College. She's one of the legislators that the Republicans in Alabama like to refer to as double dipper, because she has a state job at the same time she's in the legislature. And that they've kind of made that a campaign issue in the past few years. That seems to be their big line of attack against Democrats.
Will it be an issue in this race?
It will. If she is the Democratic nominee, I'm sure the Republican will make an issue of it. I don't know if it will go anywhere. They've had limited success with that line of attack, but they are certainly still working on trying to get that right and make that an issue that's got some traction. So it would.
Yeah, I think it's a bad one, because how are you ever going to have educators, college professors, police officers, law enforcement in office if you're not going to let folks like that serve?
Amen.
Well, they just want rich people serving. We all know that.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of that area, that's Huntsville. That's one of the most educated and affluent areas of Alabama, if I'm not mistaken. Correct, Sherry?
Correct.
So, I mean, it's good to hear Democrats are successful. Although, as we know, when people are highly educated, they're likely to vote Democrat. Now, if people are affluent and they don't necessarily have the educational background to go along with it, that's when they tend to be more Republican. So, I guess the education trumps the affluence. And Huntsville.
Sherry, I have a question for you. So this woman that you're talking about, she's a sitting state representative now?
Yes.
So if she is the candidate and wins, then they're going to have another special election?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Like six elections this year.
Yeah, well, we can totally relate to that here in Georgia. You know, we all had to vote who knows how many times this year because of all our runoffs, but I was just wondering about that.
Yeah, and you know, it's like that when you get people moving up. When you get these openings in Congress, somebody gets elected, and then maybe they leave a hole, and everybody moves up, and you get some new blood in there, which is good.
Yeah, it's good. New blood is good.
One of the candidates that's running is a young man. I just met him a few weeks ago. He's I don't know how old he is. You know, he looks like he's about 25, maybe. But he's a young man, a graduate student at Alabama. And he just spent 2 years in Washington, D.C. with the National Education Association. And the interesting thing is that he was involved in Tommy Battle's recent successful campaign to become mayor of Huntsville. That happened back then. So he's got you know, some interesting ideas, and he is definitely the fresh face in the race.
Yeah. One other issue that caught my eye, Sherry, was a bill to ban or further restrict cockfighting in Alabama. I believe Oklahoma's the only state that actually still has totally legal cockfighting. What's going on there?
This came up, the Humane Society, I believe, is trying to make cockfighting a felony everywhere, and it's not currently a felony in Alabama. It's a misdemeanor published punishable by something like a $50 fine. And it made news because the Agriculture Commissioner, Ron Sparks, who's expected to run for either lieutenant governor or governor in 2010, so he's kind of a figure somebody everybody watches, he made a pretty broad statement that if we made it a felony, that would make it, that would hurt Alabama's poultry industry by making it harder to inspect chickens for disease. And it said some fairly unpleasant things about the Humane Society, and, you know, kind of rubbed a lot of people wrong.
Yeah, I would think that the pro cockfighting lobby would be pretty small in any state. I mean, we know Michael Vick no longer has the funds to support the lobbying effort for these type of endeavors. So, well, Sherry, we read your blog and we came up with these questions, but you know, you're the person that's writing them and commenting on them and seeing all these different issues. What's something we missed that's pertinent to Alabama politics right now?
Did you miss the sheriff starving the inmates?
Oh, I missed that.
Well, tell us about it.
That was in the New York Times day before yesterday, and it was CNN's number two story. It was, you know, another case of Alabama getting national news in not a good way. In Alabama, it's legal. It's perfectly legal for sheriffs to keep the leftover money that the state provides to feed the inmates. And the state provides them the princely sum of $1.75 per day per inmate for food. And over 3 years, this sheriff in Morgan County pocketed $212,000 surplus.
Yikes.
Yeah.
I did see that, and I didn't realize that was Alabama. I was wondering, you know, that won't even buy two extra value items at most fast food restaurants. So that is quite a budget, $1.75.
Breakfast was half an egg, some grits, and a piece of toast. And supper consisted of bits of undercooked bloody chicken and some other stuff we won't go into. And inmates were documented as losing quite a bit of weight when they were in his jail. So he actually, a federal judge, put him in jail overnight. And he's he says he's going to start spending his entire allowance on food. And this is the best part. The legislature is now talking about, seriously, about changing the law to make them give the surplus back to the state if they have a surplus. And how can they have a surplus on $1.75 a day?
Yes. I mean, obviously, you hear programs like this, you know, if you cut waste. In fact, I just got a little tag on the lieutenant governor here, this cutwaste.org website. Everybody's for cutting waste, but feeding even inmates an appropriate amount of food is not waste. I mean, that's
right.
Just inhumane. That goes back to the days where they used to sell out prisoners to be like slaves.
Yeah, they're not necessarily convicted of anything. A lot of people in the county jail are awaiting trial and presumed innocent. You're not talking about punishment for these people. You're just talking about detention. So.
Well, I mean, even Charles Manson, I mean, we could say, you know, he deserves a lot of punishments, but I don't know that starving him to death, even somebody, you know, that heinous, is that the appropriate action, you know, course of action?
I think it's probably unconstitutional.
You think?
Yes.
I'm pretty sure. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm pretty
sure. I'm not a lawyer, but I stayed at a Holiday Inn last night, and I'm pretty sure it's unconstitutional.
Well, sometimes the common sense and the law really don't have that much to do with each other in some circumstances, unfortunately. Well, Sherry, we thank you for coming on the show and for doing such good work on Left in Alabama. It's one of the best blogs on Southern politics, and we hope folks that are listening to our show outside of Alabama that have never checked out or are infrequently check you out will begin to make it a daily or periodic reading portion of their, you know, political blog looking.
Well, thank you very much, and I just want to say I hope everybody starts listening to the Kudzu Vine more because it's a great show. It's really fun to be on your show and fun to listen to it.
Yes, well, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sherry.
Thanks a bunch. Bye-bye.
Yes. Well,
Tim, I know that we're winding down the Bush administration, and there was something that outraged me, and I don't have a formal outrage of the week, but I kind of wanted to go at it as a jumping off point. I'm a football coach and have coached other things, and, you know, we always talk, even if your team is losing, you finish the game. You keep playing hard. Anything you do in life, you know, whatever, you're always taught, finish it strong. Well, George
yeah.
Bush must have never learned that lesson because, you know, he is the president, and he has to be seeing that just in the last month of the year, we lost over half a billion jobs. I believe it was 584,000 jobs lost, and he is not doing anything. You would think just personal pride would say, look, we got to do something to try to make it better, even if it's a more conservative approach than a lot of us on the Democratic side would like. Try something. I'm just shocked. I'm appalled that he's just saying, hey, we'll just wait it out another 2 weeks and now another 10 days, whatever it is. It seems like he's been waiting it out for several fiscal quarters now. Catherine, Tim, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, sometimes it's a blessing in disguise. You know, what's he going to do? I mean, you're
something,
right. He should
anything.
Try to do something, but you know, whatever he does might fail like everything else he's done for the last 8 years.
Well,
but.
No, she's got a point there.
Well, if he actually focused on America instead of, you know, everything else, you know, Iraq, Iran, whatever it may be, then he might do something or stop focusing on business interests. There's probably all the business folks that are so scared because of the stock market that they're not wanting to look for a handout anyway.
Well, David, what he has chosen to do, let's be real, is basically disappear and run the clock out. I think he's got it in his head. His whole administration does now. Well, you know what? We're just going to leave all of this for the next guy to deal with, and in the meantime, we'll send Dick Cheney out to give a bunch of exit interviews and talk up our legacy. And that's exactly what they've been doing, and it's shameful. This guy is the worst president of my lifetime. There is no doubt about that. Now, we're looking at the biggest job losses, get this, folks, since 1945. We are looking at a $1.2 trillion dollar deficit. We are looking at a housing and automobile industry on its knees, and what's the president doing beside fulfilling a few ceremonial duties this weekend? He vanished, right, David?
He did. That's what I'm saying. It seems like you would be doing something. That's why I'm just shocked and appalled. I know that, I mean, you could, to me, if nothing else, okay, you look at Barack Obama's plan that he announced in Fairfax, Virginia. What portion of this plan could we go ahead and try to enact? And I know probably a lot of Republicans might hear this and say, well, he's not supposed to, you know, tote Barack Obama's water. But 82% of the people are approving of what, so far, Barack Obama's vision is for America. It looks like, you know, you have to see that it's like this is what the American people want. They're not against all this. They see that government's going to have to spend some money to try to, you know, gin up the economy to where then the private sector can then kick in. I mean, and even a lot of really conservative folks are, you know, fully admitting this, even though it's so against their nature. So I'm just kind of shocked by this. Well, since y'all
I don't know why you're shocked. I mean, why are we shocked?
Well, that's true.
I know what you're saying, but it's like you just think that if you just have any, you know, rational thought, any pride. I mean, you just want to you just see that if you had the office, wouldn't you do something? And I tell you, another shocker, I guess, the Bush family did get was Laura Bush signed her book contract, and apparently the book companies don't really think anybody wants to read it. Did y'all see that number? How much, how many millions less is she being advanced compared to Hillary Clinton?
Oh, I didn't see the number, but I'm sure. Yeah, who's going to read her book?
Tim, do you happen to know the number?
I do not have the number in front of me, no, but I knew it was significantly less than what Senator Clinton was advanced. I do know that.
It was like a quarter, if I'm not mistaken. It was like,
yeah,
say,
something
8
like
million
that. It
to
was
2
huge.
Million.
It was huge.
It really was pretty stark, and it just, you know, I guess maybe they don't think Republicans by books.
Well,
that Hillary Clinton's such an intriguing figure that we'll see.
There
as a
we
leader,
go.
And people think, you know,
you're comparing Hillary Clinton and Laura Bush.
Yeah.
Most Republicans would rather read Hillary Clinton's book.
You're probably right, but the reason they get compared, well, they lived in the same house, and they happened to, you know, be, if you, you know, one of those full color first lady books where they tell facts forever in time, they're going to sit side by side on pages or back to back, if you know, in order. So that's why they're going to get compared. Other things going on with the White House that kind of shocked me, but once again, why does it shock us, is the Obamas wanted to go ahead and move to Washington early so their daughters could start school. And the Bush family said, well, you can't move into Blair House, which has full security. You have to move into a hotel because it's booked. And one guy, John Howard, the former prime minister of Australia, is apparently staying in the entire 100-something room house. You just have a feeling if John Howard was asked about this, he might have been willing to give up, oh, 3 or 4 rooms of the 100-some-odd rooms in Blair House, but you can tell it was just the Bush administration wanting to freeze the Obamas out, and I thought it was just such a tacky move when you're having these pictures that look so nice with you, your father, President Carter, President Clinton, and Barack Obama all together, you know, complimenting rugs and whatnot, but in the other side, you're trying to, you know, lock the family out of just, you know, being good parents, trying to give their kids a more stable home to start school in instead of starting a few weeks into the term. And, you know, going to Chicago part of the time. Catherine, your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I agree that it seemed a little strange that they couldn't, you know, get the people in the Blair House to, you know, move out to the hotel where Barack Obama's staying. Seemed like a logical thing to do. On the other hand, they're staying in a perfectly comfortable hotel. I'm sure they're, you know, perfectly fine. And it may be a little, you know, tempest in a teapot.
Well, this is cost of the taxpayers money and not really stimulus money, because I don't think putting more money in the Secret Service is stimulus. They're having to now secure the Hay Adams Hotel instead of being in the Blair House, which already has
security. You're right. But, yeah, I mean, you're right. I don't disagree with you. I just don't think it's as big a – I mean, a lot of people have been making a big deal about it. It just doesn't strike me as that big a deal. You know, generally speaking, that the Blair House is supposed to be available for, like, the 5 days before the inauguration. And from what I understand, it will be available for them for that time. And that's the, you know, sort of the tradition. And, I mean
– And I think it's a tradition they need to look at. Given that we know school starts back in January, I mean, of the last how many presidents, like from Kennedy on, Kennedy had school-age children, Carter had school-age children, Clinton, now Obama. Isn't that strange? They're all Democrats that have had school-age children. And correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe any of the Republicans had school-age children.
No.
Nixon, I don't believe so.
No.
But it's obviously something that's going to come
up.
Well,
I agree with you. I think that what I think is that immediately following the election, there should be a secure residence available to the
absolutely.
Because, I mean, honestly, it's, you know, maybe in times past, generations ago, it wasn't so important. You know, there weren't as many pressing global issues facing the incoming president as there are in these times. So I think having a secure residence for them to use between the election and the inauguration is probably something they should talk about. We should solve. Make Blair House available between November 5th or, you know, the first Wednesday.
Well, probably just after sometime after Christmas, just right after New Year's Day, could be the second. Because, I mean, honestly, this is – I mean,
Barack Obama, I mean, I think he could have stayed in Chicago longer and still done his work, although I guess maybe he wanted to get away from
Chicago. I think he wanted to get out of Chicago.
Just the taint of that place. If only that were a southern state, we'd have topics for week after week. I'm kind of glad we don't have those kind of more of those states to discuss those kind of topics. Well, Tim, I'm not able to keep time too well being here live at the Wild Hog Supper. This place is finally starting to clear out, although there's still, you know, a few hundred people in here, although a few hundred compared to a few thousand makes it seem like a ghost town compared.
Well, David, we've got about 5 minutes, and I wanted to return to a subject that we just skirted over a little bit that Catherine had talked back about issues in Atlanta. We have not yet talked about the Atlanta mayoral race and how it may be shaping up. And I noticed in the AJC that Kasim Reed had raised $431,000 for the mayor's race. And I wanted to turn to both of you guys and ask you, is Kasim Reed the favorite, or is there someone else out there that's going to challenge him strongly? Catherine, I know you had a name.
Well, I think Kasim is certainly the favorite at this point, but I do think that Mary Norwood has really been, she's been running now for like over a year. I get mail from her, you know, at least a couple times a month, and I think she's very serious about running against Kasim for the mayor of Atlanta.
Yes,
I mean, you heard about
obviously, full disclosure, I work for Kasim Reed's campaign. I've worked for state senate campaign for a few cycles, and now I'm working for the mayoral campaign. So I'm not an objective judge. I do think, you know, the fundraising disclosures, and of course I always say, you know, money's not everything, but you put the fundraising with the experience and actually serving in government, him working so closely with Shirley Franklin's campaign. I mean, when Lisa Borders, you know, moved out of the race, that certainly made him, I think he was already the favorite, but that made him even more of a favorite. I think if he has a good session, keeps working hard, I mean, it's just he's the front runner, and he'll stay that way. I did see Jesse White, I believe, who's running for mayor of Atlanta. He was working the room. He did have a mayor of Atlanta, name badge saying that he was running. Jesse White, I believe, he's a lawyer at one of the larger law firms.
Mm-hmm.
So he was working the room here tonight. I'm trying to, you know, be objective in my kudzu vine role because I want it to be a good, objective show. He was working the room, so I did see him here. I didn't see everybody here, obviously, but he was the one candidate I saw, although I would suspect being a legislative event that a state senator, Kasim Reed, would have been here. I just didn't happen to see everyone tonight.
Well, will Mayor Franklin be, I guess the word is neutral. Will she be neutral in the mayoral race?
It would be speculation on my part, and I probably shouldn't be doing that speculation, so I'm going to let Catherine speculate.
I don't know. And honestly, I don't know if her support at this stage in the game is a help or a hindrance.
Well, I mean, even people like Dick Williams, I mean, he was talking about, I mean, he was praising Shirley Franklin overall. I mean, you had, this morning on Georgia Gang, you had Alexis Scott, who obviously praised Shirley Franklin. But you had Dick Williams doing it, too.
They were dreadfully mistaken in praising Shirley Franklin this week because she made a couple of big mistakes this week. And if she's not paying attention to what people are saying on the ground, she's making a big mistake for her legacy.
Well, I mean,
this crime thing is very, very serious. And she made a State of Atlanta address on Monday that was filled with, I love Shirley Franklin, but I can't help but say that it was all spin. Trying to say that crime rates are down and, you know,
saying throughout her term, if you look at the two terms.
I know, throughout her term.
I think, and that may be true. I think crime is rising. I think you were alluding to it, the economy's bad. Now, the trick will be, what is Clayton's crime, DeKalb's crime, Gwinnett's crime, Cobb's crime? I mean, and if all of them are up around the same percent, well, it's just a regional thing. If Atlanta's up more or less than that, those surrounding areas, then that might be something you can analyze, you know, just because it's something to look at. But I believe we're winding down. Tim, go ahead and close us out.
Okay. The clock is ticking away on the live feed, and we'd like to thank all of our guests that were on with us tonight, both from the Wild Hog Supper and from Alabama. And we, of course, would like to thank you, David, and Catherine, and bid you a good night.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
Bye.